Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. By the end of this century, the majority of people living in the United States will trace their origins not to Europe, but to Latin America. By 2050, the Latino community is expected to reach 130 million people, one-third of the total U.S. population. In the groundbreaking book, Harvest of Empire, award-winning journalist Juan Gonzalez argues that we cannot understand the enormous Latino presence in the United States unless we understand the United States' role in Latin America. The new documentary film by the same name is based on Juan Gonzalez's book. It draws direct connections between the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America and mass migration from a number of countries, including Mexico, Cuba, and Guatemala. Through rare archival material and interviews with journalists, authors, activists, and artists, Harvest of Empire paints a vivid picture of the transformation of the United States. And here's a clip from the new documentary.
They never teach us in school that the huge Latino presence here is a direct result of our own government's actions in Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central America over many decades. Actions that forced millions from that region to leave their homeland and journey north. My father was born in Puerto Rico.
And that's a clip from the film Harvest of Empire, which opens this Friday in Northern California. At a time of heated debate over the future of immigration, how would understanding history help us move towards a just immigration policy? And what happens when historical context is missing from the conversation? In fact, it's rarely mentioned when you hear the talking heads talk about immigration. Today, we are joined by Juan Gonzalez. He is co-host of Democracy Now! And award-winning journalist. The documentary film Harvest of Empire, a history of Latinos in America, is based on his groundbreaking book. And Juan joins us from his office in New York. Hi, Juan. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and it's such a good film. It's kind of amazing when you think about the fact that this very important history is missing from so much of the immigration debate. And you have covered Latino communities across this country for more than 30 years. Why did you decide to chronicle this history?
Well, when I started working on the book Harvest of Empire in the early 1990s, actually, it came out, the first edition came out around 2000. I was furious, really, about the various histories that I had read on the Latino community in the United States that somehow or other failed to first of all, to make the connection between how and why the migrants left their countries originally, and the problems that they faced as they settled here in the United States and the various communities, not just the Mexican and the Puerto Rican community who have gotten the most attention, but also increasingly in the late 60s and early 70s, the Cubans and Dominicans, and then in the 80s, the Nicaraguans, the Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Hondurans, and then later on, the Colombians and increasingly Peruvians and Ecuadorians. And this was, first of all, the Latino experience in America is extremely diverse, and it has its own particularities in terms of who came, when they came, why they came, so that there was a lot of ethnic differences that were all being lumped together in one sort of Latino experience that I wanted to explore, but also why they came. And I think this is the key lesson of the book, and that's why the title, Harvest of Empire, the Latino presence in the United States is really the unintended harvest of the American empire in Latin America, to the same degree that you find with all of the advanced developed countries right now. And for several decades now, France has been confronting its own, quote, immigration problem. Mm. It doesn't know what to do about all the Algerians and Tunisians and Moroccans that have moved to France over the last 30, 40 years, the same way that England doesn't know what to do about all the Indians, Pakistanis, and Jamaicans, or that Germany doesn't know what to do about the large Turkish minority that has developed within the country. And when you look at it, really, the reason why there are so many Algerians, Tunisians, and Moroccans in France is because those were the colonies of France. Mm-hmm. The reason why there's so many Indians, Pakistanis, and Jamaicans in England is because those were the colonies of England. And really, since World War II, the Third World has been increasingly coming to the West, and they've usually followed the migratory routes from the former colonies to the metropolis, to the colonizer nation. And so you really cannot understand the Latino presence in the United States unless you first understand America's role in Latin America, both government policy as well as economic and corporate policy in Latin America that created so much dislocation that it ended up propelling millions of people to leave their homeland and journey northward.
And why do you think this is rarely discussed? Because you have a number of interviews with people who have left their home countries to come to the U.S. And Mariana Cabrera, a Guatemalan immigrant, I think she says what so many people in the film feel. She said, quote, people in the U.S. have no idea why we come to this country, no idea. And if they do, it's probably the wrong idea. Why do you think it's so rare for anyone to say, why is it that so many people come to the U.S.?
Well, I think obviously in the United States we have an ongoing problem with historical memory and how our past has shaped our present. There's so little attention clearly paid in the media to it, and unfortunately, in the history books that we were taught with in school, they generally have not provided a more comprehensive perspective on history. It's usually been European-centered or European settler-centered, and so we don't really grasp the enormous role that our country has played in Latin American affairs throughout the 19th century and, of course, increasingly in the early 20th century and with the gunboat diplomacy of people like Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson and others. And now, increasingly, in the late after World War II, in trying to control economic policy throughout Latin America and to prop up governments or dictators that were willing to make it easier for our corporations to do business in Latin America. And so little of the policy was geared at helping to improve the standard of living and the lives of the Latin American people themselves. And as a result, people were forced to flee, either because of civil wars fomented as a result of U.S. government policy, or in the case of Mexico specifically, economic policies that devastated Mexico and made it impossible for millions of Mexicans to stay in their homeland.
And Juan, you have a very personal story in all of this. Your family was born in Puerto Rico. This is how you open the film. And you talk about how your family was thrust into deep poverty and hunger during the Great Depression. Your grandmother had to give her children away to neighbors so they could be fed. You don't really hear much about Puerto Rican history in the United States. So talk a little bit about just, you know, delving into this history. How did it affect you?
Well, obviously, most directly, we have a great clip in the film from President Truman talking about the devastation wrought in Puerto Rico in the early 20th century by the American sugar companies that came to dominate the economy of the island. So from the very beginning of the U.S. occupation in 1898 and then the decision of Congress to keep Puerto Rico as a colonial possession throughout the 20th century, the effects on the island were enormous. Beginning with that, one of the first things that the U.S. government did was it declared English the official language of the island and insisted on all teaching in the schools of Puerto Rico be in English. It led to a virtual collapse of the educational system of Puerto Rico, because for 400 years, Puerto Ricans had been speaking Spanish, and then suddenly the Americans arrive on the island and declare a change in the language and brought hundreds of teachers from the United States to reestablish a new educational system. Well, that, of course, was a complete failure. It wasn't until the late 1940s when the first elected governor of Puerto Rico, Muñoz Marín, comes into power that he reintroduces Spanish as the language of instruction on the island of Puerto Rico, with English being taught as a second language.
Like in Native Americans, as you point out in the film, children were punished for speaking Spanish in school in Puerto Rico.
Right, throughout the 30s and the early 40s. The cultural impact of that, but as well the main problem during the 30s in Puerto Rico was that because the island had been changed almost completely to a sugarcane growing economy, once commodity prices collapsed in the 30s, and the rest of the world was not buying sugar, you had massive unemployment and starvation on the island. And as I say in the film, my grandmother was forced to give away her children for about 8 to 10 years that they grew up with different families, because she could not afford to feed them anymore. Of course, that led to enormous psychological problems within the family, with not only with my father, but with all of his brothers and sisters who felt abandoned by their own mother. And it wasn't until just before the beginning of World War II, when gradually, as the economy began to improve a little bit, all of her children were reunited again with their mother, but they all had the scars of that for the rest of their lives, of those separations. Several of them ended up being abused in the families that they were given away to, and it created enormous problems within the family as a whole.
So talk a little bit about the migration, your parents coming to the United States. Why did they do it, and how did they do it?
Well, my father and his two brothers all fought in World War II, part of the way that many young Puerto Ricans of that era were able to escape poverty and starvation was joining the military. So you had an entire Spanish-speaking regiment from Puerto Rico that went through North Africa and Italy and Germany during World War II. It's called the 65th Infantry. So they were all part of the 65th Infantry. And once they returned to Puerto Rico after the war, and of course, they understand they entered the military all speaking Spanish. None of them spoke a word of English. But that was fine with the military at the time, just as long as they could fight. And when they came back to Puerto Rico, there was things had improved somewhat, but it was still difficult to find a job. So in 1946, one by one, all the brothers started coming to New York City to work, and so that's basically how my family settled in New York right after the war. That was the beginning of the great Puerto Rican migration. There had been a smaller Puerto Rican community in New York City from the late 19th century, and then after World War I, it grew a little more. But the huge migration occurred between 1946 and 1960, when about a million Puerto Ricans moved to the United States, mostly to New York City.
And one of the greatest airborne migrations in history. And you talk about the fact that thousands of Puerto Ricans were recruited to work in the United States. By 2003, Puerto Ricans living in the U.S. outnumber the population on the island. And today there are 5 million Puerto Ricans living in the U.S. How do you think...
Close to 5 million, yes.
How do you think this affected your childhood growing up in New York City?
Well, clearly, in the 1950s and the early 1960s, Puerto Ricans in New York City were largely invisible people. Mm-hmm. They were mostly my My mother worked as a garment worker. My father worked as a restaurant worker, and they were heavily in the restaurant services and hotel industry, as well as in the garment industry of Manhattan. They experienced enormous discrimination, and in fact, in the film, Anthony Romero, who is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, most people don't know he is Puerto Rican himself. He talks about the racial discrimination that his father encountered as a hotel worker, so that they experienced enormous racial discrimination, but pretty much accepted it as part of the price of just being able to escape the situations that they faced in their homeland. But it wasn't until, I guess, our generation, the first generation raised here in the United States, started on finishing school, that we realized that the kind of mistreatment and abuse that Puerto Ricans were being subjected to was not something that we were going to stand for. And that's why you had the development of the first generation rebellion in the 60s and 70s of many young Puerto Ricans, mm-hmm. as well as Chicanos out west, and the various movements that developed in the 1960s and 1970s. In our case, it was the Young Lords. In the case of the Chicanos, it was Los Siete de la Raza, and the Alianza de los Pueblos of Reyes Tijerina, and the La Raza Unida Party of Corky Gonzalez in Colorado, and other Chicanos in Texas as well. And here there were other groups as well that developed, El Comité MEMP and the Puerto Rican Socialist Party and others, that all developed in sort of in an attempt to respond to the constant racial and ethnic discrimination that Puerto Ricans were subjected to.
We're speaking with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, about the new documentary film, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. It is based on the book by the same name by Juan Gonzalez, and it opens this Friday in Northern California. An excellent film. You can check out the trailer right now on our website at yourcallradio.org. It takes a look at the connections between the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America and mass migration from so many countries: Cuba, Guatemala, El Salvador, Mexico. And we'd love to hear from you. If you trace your origins to Latin America, how did you or your parents end up in the U.S.? What was behind your family's decision to leave their country? And what do you think it'll take to really replace this historical narrative with the stereotypes we keep hearing about immigrants, especially Mexicans? We rarely hear about historical context here. We rarely have, you know, the talking heads ask people, well, why did you decide to come here? What are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And how do you think this should affect the somewhat ugly, very ugly, I guess we can call it, debate we're having about immigration in the United States? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Juan, when you think about historical context, what would you like to see? How would you like to infuse that into the debate we have today?
Well, I think one thing that the film does well, and what I try to do in my book, but with different subjects, is first of all, for people to grasp the human story, that it is incredibly it's an amazing story, the various groups that have come here, and these are human beings who had no choice, really, but to leave. We have an incredible interview with a Mexican immigrant who is now the head of brain surgery at Johns Hopkins University, and who actually migrated to this country as a child because his family was starving after the peso devaluation crisis, one of the many that have occurred in Mexico, and his family was starving. starving in Mexicali, and they basically decided to cross the border and come here. And he tells the enormous influence on him as a child of seeing his relatives come from the United States with sacks of food. Meanwhile, they're starving in Mexicali, and that's when he decided that he had to somehow get to the United States. But he links it directly to the economic conditions in Mexico, and there is a long segment about the impact of NAFTA on the Mexican countryside, and the nearly 2 million Mexican farmers that have been thrown off the land as a result of NAFTA and of the dumping or the of so much corn and wheat from the United States into Mexico that it made it impossible for them to be able to compete. So that, you know, what we tried to do is not only tell the economic underpinnings of the changes that have occurred, but then also expose people to some real human beings who have managed to make a life in the United States, not only survive, but actually to become leaders in their fields. Juno Diaz, for instance, the great Pulitzer Prize-winning author, who himself was an immigrant that came here in this country from the Dominican Republic. And he says that he is in the United States because of what the United States did to his country in 1965 with the Dominican invasion and occupation of the Dominican Republic, and that the effects of that occupation and the catastrophe that was wrought within his country led to so many thousands of Dominicans leaving and coming here to the United States. So we show some of the less known individual heroic stories, like the woman you mentioned, Maria Cabrera, the Guatemalan immigrant. But we also talk about Dr. Hinojosa, the brain surgeon, and Juno Diaz, the great writer, and Geraldo Rivera, the television commentator. All of these folks tell the migrant stories in their families to humanize the situation and take it away from these sound bites of illegal immigrants and aliens and people who are creating, who are trying to come to this country to benefit off the government programs, and to really sort of tell the human story behind the immigration stereotypes.
We're going to go to break soon, but what kind of media attention is this getting? Have you had a call from Fox News to talk about the history behind this immigration?
Not yet, but you're well aware that since the last election, there's been a change of tenor in most of the discussions on immigration these days, and now everyone is talking about some kind of a reform, and of course now the question will be, what do they mean by comprehensive immigration reform? The devil will be in the details, in the battles that will be waged in Congress from now through the summer over trying to craft an immigration bill that meets the needs of the America of the 21st century.
We're speaking with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, about the new documentary, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. Juan is author of the book by the same name, and this excellent documentary opens this Friday in Northern California. You can find links at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. If you and your family are from Latin America, we'd love to hear your personal story. What will it take to really bring this historical context into the debate about immigration? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your Call on Local Public Radio is a program that depends on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. And it's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click on the email newsletter link at the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up, we'll have a conversation about taxes. What can we learn from UK Uncut? That is the group in the UK that has successfully pressured multinationals to actually pay their taxes. Here in the US, there's a huge debate about the deficit, while tax loopholes are rarely mentioned. So we will talk about that tomorrow. And then we're also putting shows together about sounds under the water. How does the U.S. Navy's sonar program affect underwater life like whales and dolphins? That's coming up on Thursday. The San Francisco Ocean Film Festival opens on Friday. Be sure to check this out. Really incredible films about the ocean, underwater life, the environment, and what we're currently facing. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, about the new documentary Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. It opens widely this Friday in Northern California. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Juan is the author of the book by the same name, and it really connects the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America and mass migration from a number of countries, including Mexico, Cuba, and Guatemala. By the year 2050, the Latino community is expected to reach 130 million people. This is one-third of the total U.S. population. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've got a story you'd like to share about how you came to the U.S. or your parents, we'd love to hear from you. And what will it take to bring this historical context to the often very ugly racist debate that we're hearing about immigration? How could it change the conversation? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And speaking of the ugly debate, why don't we hear another clip from the film? And we'll begin this with the voice of David Brooks, who has a column in the New York Times. He also appears on NPR every Friday. Here's a clip from Harvest of Empire.
Listen, I'm for pretty open immigration, but when the immigrants come, they come with a culture of criminality. It's out of control.
They put a strain on our Social Security, our education, our health care.
American history is replete with upsurges of anti-immigrant fervor. Immigration has always been a big battleground because there's always an attempt of those who came a while ago to then paint those who came more recently as the problem.
The greatest danger we have is ignorance, because when people act out of ignorance, they usually act in ways that they come to regret later on.
And that is a clip from the new documentary, Harvest of Empire, which opens this Friday in Northern California. And we have a number of people on the line. So let's hear from Rick in El Sobrante. Hi, Rick. Welcome to the show. Hello, Rick. All right. Let's try our next caller. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. What's your name?
Oh, hello. I'm Clark.
Hi, Clark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just curious if your guest knows of any study that's being done on the effect of micas and seguros on an economy that's going from manufacturing to service.
And where is this?
Pardon me?
Where is this?
In the United States.
Juan, are you familiar with this?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't quite hear him. If you could repeat the question.
Can you repeat that, Clark?
Yes. I was curious if you know of any study that's being done on the effect of micas and seguros on an economy that's going from manufacturing to service.
On micas and seguros?
Yes. Yes.
What are you referring to specifically?
Resident alien cards, matricula, driver's licenses, and Social Security cards. Micas and seguros. Maybe you could define it for your lay listeners.
No, I'm not familiar with micas and seguros. That's why I'm trying to get your understanding of what that is.
It's documents such as driver's license, Social Security card, matricula, and resident alien cards.
And what about it, Clark?
Oh, you mean that are being sold
yes,
to undocumented immigrants?
Any kind of immigrants, really.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, there is no doubt that there's a whole corrupt industry that has developed in this country by people who try to take advantage of a situation by selling false documents. Obviously, identity theft and false documents is a big business in this country in all kinds of fields, not just in immigration. But I think that when you're saying that this is having an impact on the American economy, I mean, there's no doubt that there needs to be a more well-organized and immigration system. The immigration system that we currently have is broken in many ways, and there's definitely been an attempt by the government in recent years to increase border security and efforts to eliminate fraudulent documents in the process. But what I've tried to do in my book, and what this film attempts to do, is to try to tell a more complete view of why it is that there are so many people from Latin America coming to the United States. Not to get caught up in the specifics of how attempts are being made to stem the flow, but to understand what has caused the flow, because you cannot fashion a solution to a problem whose origin you don't understand. My hope is that as Congress begins to debate immigration reform, that the lawmakers as well as the general public will try to first understand what is causing these massive flows of undocumented migrants, because first of all, the largest group of migrants who are in the country illegally come from one country. 70% of the undocumented population in the United States, 65 to 70%, comes from Mexico. Mm-hmm. So you solve the problem of what is causing so many people from Mexico to come to the United States, and you've solved the major part of the problem. So I think that that's what I try to do in the book, as well as what the filmmakers try to do when they try to adapt my book to the screen.
And in the film, 33 million Mexicans now live in the United States. And as you point out, and a lot of people just don't know this, I mean, it's basic history, but we don't talk about it. And that is that Mexicans were recruited into the U.S. and then shipped out. And as you point out, it's two countries, but one economy. And the Mexicans functioned as a reserve labor force, basically. Well, we need you now, so come on in, and then 6 months later, we don't need you, so get out. I mean, that's hardly ever mentioned.
Yeah, and well, not only that, but then Mexico, because, see, people forget Mexico is the largest Spanish-speaking country in the world, far bigger in population than Spain or any other Spanish-speaking country, and it still remains desperately poor, although there's been some improvement in its economy in the last few years. It still remains desperately poor. So you have a country of 100 million people, which is roughly the population of Mexico today, sharing a 2,000-mile border, a desperately poor country, with the world's richest country. And the problem is that the United States has continued to use Mexico not only to extract resources, but increasingly as a cheap labor supply now, with so many companies moving to Mexico to do production. So you've got the problem that unless we do something to help improve the living standards in Mexico, it is inevitable that people will continue to try to flee that country into this country, because it is, as I say in the film, it's two countries but one economy.
We're speaking with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, about the new documentary, Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. And Juan is author of the book by the same name. This documentary opens in Northern California this Friday. And be sure to check out the links. You can see the trailer at our website, yourcallradio.org. We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in just a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave a comment on our website so others can see it at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Kat in Oakland. Hi, Kat. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hello, Juan Gonzalez. Listen, I want to make two points. The first is kind of light and fun for the author. I encountered your textbook after wanting to take a class about 15 years after. I'm from the border of San Diego, and I'm white, and I've worked on farms in the East County, and I've also encountered the Minutemen in the 90s. I also didn't see Tijuana much after the early 90s, and therefore encountered all the stuff about the maquiladoras and stuff through the textbook and well into the new millennia with a lot of shock, being well connected to the border in my youth. One thing I'd like to say about the textbook was it was delightful to go to my class and facing a kind of intimidating-looking, scary Indio teacher, and after about half the class realizing that he actually went to my high school and is now a doctor. And then, you know, making that connection, you know, of course changed everything, and he was the most amazing professor. Two, this is my second point I'd like to make, because my concern mostly now is not just the mere racism of people when they look at a Mexican face and all their assumptions that they're doing in the white community. It's that right now we have an epidemic of disappeared and murdered people in Mexico. That number has probably doubled that of Argentina's in its period. This is also a reason people are leaving. And they're not just quote-unquote fleeing. People are sending their children, if they can get a student visa, for any possible purpose. I have a friend who, not being a musician, all of a sudden became a cello player so his parents could get him out of the country. Okay? So people need to reason that there is a far more complex thing in this situation. And I'd also like to propose...
All right, Kat, thank you for calling. We've got full lines, and we'll get a response from Juan in just a couple of minutes. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to Lucia in San Francisco. Hi, Lucia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I came in the 1980s from 1980 from Colombia. I was 20 years old. And I came from a middle-class family. I came because I fell in love with someone from the U.S. But I would say the biggest problem for me is that as I came, the first thing I found that this man was very abusive, and he was clearly producing an emotional, difficult life for me every single day. He knew that I didn't have a place to go, and that's why every time I spoke to him or we had an argument, he would say, if you want to leave, leave right now. Mm. He knew I didn't have a place to go. So after I had left, I decided I was going to stay here. That was my first point. Because he would say, oh, why you can't do... He expected that because I was from Latin America, I was going to be very submissive. He didn't want me to have friends. He didn't want me to be out of the house. He said, if my mother doesn't have friends, why do you have to have friends? So it didn't make any sense to him. So that was the first point. The second point is that I came from a middle-class family, and I was expecting that people here had regular meals three times a day with balanced diet. But then when I came, I didn't know that he didn't have enough money for even two meals a day. Mm. We had to actually put water in the milk to be able to make milk last for two more weeks and do things like that. And he never told me that was the kind of life I was going to have before I came. So it was a very long process for me to adjust and to see what the reality was. Because when we are in other countries, we think that the life is like in the movies. Like,
right.
Live in very comfortable ways. Everyone has beautiful house. Everyone has the basic ways of survival. But no one tells outside the U.S. that there are starving people in this country.
Right, and you almost feel trapped. Lucia, just quickly, how did you get out of that situation?
Well, I started going to college. And then I went to the counselor at the university. and there, but everything has to be under the table. He would never know because he would get really mad at me if he knew I was going to counseling. Mm. And all my counseling was for being able to leave the marriage. So finally, I was able to leave him 1 year before I got my bachelor's degree.
Wow. Well, I'm glad, so glad that happened, and congratulations. Thank you so much for calling. I mean, Juan, Lucia just brings up one story of millions about not only how hard it is, as you tell in the film, to cross the border, and there's so many deaths at the border, but then what happens after you actually get here?
Yes, and again, that people from different nations in Latin America who have come here have had different experiences. She was saying she was from Colombia, and in my book, although we don't get as much into it in the film, I talk about those early Colombian migrations that were largely middle-class migrations. There were people that were in somewhat better economic conditions in their own countries, as were the Cubans who initially came from Cuba, and unlike the Puerto Ricans and Mexicans, which were largely working class and farm worker migrations in large numbers, they had different experiences. They had some skills when they came here, but they too were thrust into sort of a second class status here in the United States, because obviously if they're undocumented, whether they are in a family situation as she was, or if they're in, if they're working for an employer under the table or unofficially, then they're subject to enormous abuse by their spouses, by their employers, because they know that the person effectively under their control has no rights as someone who is undocumented in this country, in terms of, because if they speak out, they face the possibility of being deported. So that this is one of the huge issues for the 11 million undocumented in the country. Obviously, the young people, the dreamers, have been the ones who have raised their voices and made the plight of the rest of the 11 million brought it out, because they have been living in the shadows, in this sort of netherworld, much needed by the country, because their cheap labor produces some of the prosperity that the rest of us depend on, but at the same time invisible and in the shadows because they don't have a legal status within the country.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Lucia. And let's go next to Ramiro in Watsonville. Hi, Ramiro. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. And thank you to Mr. Gonzalez for his work on this issue. I just wanted to share my experience. My parents came undocumented in the late 70s from Mexico. Just my mom is from a coastal state in Mexico, Nayarit, where tobacco was a huge, huge industry. And, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, the Mexican president started giving way to neoliberalist, ideas, mainly from pressure from United States foreign policy and companies, you know. And this is when Mexico really started to what I call, going down the NAFTA road. It didn't start in 1994 when Carlos Salinas de Gortari, signed NAFTA. It started way before that with neoliberalist policies, and that's when we start to see a big influx of people coming from Mexico to the United States. And in 1994 is when the president sealed, Mexico's fate. It became like legal policy, and so I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that, right now the president, the United States is still funneling a lot of weapons to Mexico to fund the war on drugs, the war on terror, and the Mexican government uses these weapons against its people. Mm-hmm. It happened in Acteal, happened in Oaxaca, and so a lot of these reasons of why people are leaving Mexico, and I think that before we talk in this country about immigration reform, we have to talk about foreign policy reform and how to make these changes so that people don't have to leave their country. So once again, thank you very much, and I look forward to any comments from Mr. Gonzalez.
All right, thank you, Ramiro. And to that point, Juan, we have an email from Jackie who says, I'm hoping for balance on today's subject. I traveled deep into the mountains in Mexico before NAFTA and lived with a family a four and a half hour walk from the nearest road. They had 10% of their regional population die of starvation a few years before. This problem is not solely caused by American trade. We need to remember how poor people were. I can imagine well-intentioned Americans wanting to see people have more food. We need the whole perspective. What are your thoughts on that one?
Well, I agree that we need the whole perspective, but she talks about meeting people who lived in poverty in Mexico before NAFTA. But we have to understand that United States policy, as the previous caller said, did not toward Mexico did not begin with NAFTA. You could go back to the late 19th century and the Porfirio Diaz dictatorship in Mexico, which really was the government that began developing all of the economic and trade ties with Mexico, the exploitation of Mexico's resources by American companies, the American railroads that came in Mexico at that time, the mining companies, the large landowners. It was the Porfirio Diaz 30-year dictatorship that began selling the Mexican resources to the United States and laid the basis for the deep poverty that exists in Mexico today. And as in fact, the Mexican Revolution of 1910 was really the effort to throw off the Porfirio Diaz dictatorship, and for a while Mexico began to progress somewhat in the 30s and 40s, as a result of the Mexican Revolution, as a result of the creation of a national oil company instead of a British and American oil American-owned oil companies in Mexico, so there was some progress in the 30s and 40s and 50s in Mexico. But then again, as the previous speaker, previous caller said, you started having sort of neoliberal policies that went back to some of the Porfirio Diaz policies of the late 19th century. I agree with her that the poverty in Mexico predated NAFTA, but American efforts to control the Mexican economy go way back. They go back to the 19th century.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Jackie. And again, we're speaking with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez about the new documentary, Harvest of Empire. It opens this Friday in Northern California. And we've got time for a few more callers. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi. Yes, good morning, Rose. I wanted to ask Juan, you said that the person you interviewed from the Dominican Republic tied his immigration to what happened in the Dominican Republic, and most people, I'm sure, listening don't know about who Bosch is or Balaguer or Trujillo, and I encourage them to Google that and look up that story because it's so amazing. But I was wondering what the reasons were, A, and B, I was wondering if there wasn't a backlash by manufacturers and farms that need this undocumented migrant labor to support themselves in their conflict with the Tea Partiers that want to keep everybody out and send them back. And how is that playing out?
On the second part of your question, you're saying that there is a backlash from farmers, or there's because I think the farm agribusiness and farmers are one of the main proponents these days of some kind of a comprehensive immigration reform, because they have found, as a result of all of the mass deportations and crackdowns of the last few years, that agribusiness is having a major problem having enough people to pick the crops in America, so that you're finding that the agribusiness and the farmers across America right now are very much in favor of Congress passing some sort of immigration reform. The problem will be that they may want immigration reform, a temporary guest worker program, where the workers have as few rights as possible, so that in effect they're captives of the particular farms that they work for. If there is to be a guest worker program for farm workers in the United States, it should be one that enables the farm workers, even though they are not citizens and even though they are temporary migrants, to have basic labor rights. Otherwise, they will be exploited in the ways that they were, farm workers were in the 1950s. And 60s in this country. On the first part of the question, yes, there's a long history which the film gets into, which my book gets into, in terms of
the rise of Trujillo, the great notorious dictator in the Dominican Republic for more than 30 years, who was actually trained and put into power over the Dominican military by the United States, and then the Bush rebellion, or the election of the first democratically elected president in Dominican history, Juan Bosch, who was then overthrown by the military in 1963. And that is what led to eventually the U.S. occupation, when Lyndon Johnson sent in 25,000 U.S. Marines to help the generals who had overthrown Bosch be able to keep the population down. So when Junot Diaz talks about him, he and his family arriving in 1974, that's as a result of the crushing of the popular uprising in the Dominican Republic that his family and many others came to the United States.
And Juan, we just have 30 seconds left. I think it's interesting that because the Republicans lost in 2012, all of a sudden they're for immigration reform. But what are your thoughts about where this debate is going?
Well, I think that there's going to be some kind of a bill passed, but as I said earlier, the devil will be in the details. Will it be a real comprehensive immigration reform, or will it be some sham reform? And people need to pay close attention to the specifics of the bill to assure that we have an immigration reform that adequately meets the needs of the country in the 21st century.
Juan Gonzalez is co-host of Democracy Now! We're talking about the documentary Harvest of Empire, which opens this Friday in Northern California. Juan is author of the book by the same name. Juan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Sorry about that at the end of the show there. We'll get those lines fixed. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What can we learn from UK Uncut? On the next Shore Call, we'll speak with the group that has successfully pressured multinationals to pay taxes in Britain. In the United States, the conversation is dominated by the deficit, while tax loopholes are rarely mentioned. A recent study found that tax havens cost state governments in the U.S. $40 billion a year. So what will it take to raise awareness about tax dodgers, and how are tax havens affecting the economy? It's Shore Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Have you ever asked yourself, am I going crazy?
The notion is that if you see things or hear things, you're going mad. But as a physician, I have to try and define what's going on and to reassure people that they're not going insane.
I'm Guy Raz, the place between madness and sanity. It's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Tune in to Cross Currents today at 5. We'll get on the bus with San Francisco youth riding Muni free of charge.
It started in a small room, just, you know, a couple pieces of pizza. And people are like, we should make free Muni for young people. And we thought it was never possible, but, you know, as evidenced by today, it is something that is possible.
Free Muni for young people. That's today at 5 on Cross Currents.
Cross Currents, 5 o'clock this evening here on KALW San Francisco.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say on the BBC. I'm Ben James. This is the program where we reflect the conversations you're having.
We are yearning for a good Kenya, so we have to accept if my candidates are not the ones that will lead the government. I'll have to accept it. It's a democratic thing. Majority rules.
K Kenya has voted. So what's polling day been like there? We're going to hear the conversation between Kenyans from various corners of their country. Which issues have influenced people's decisions about who to vote for? Post your points and your experiences on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, after a baby girl in Mississippi appears to have been cured of HIV, you've got lots of questions. We've got a couple of experts ready to try to answer them. You can send your question on email to worldhaveyoursay.